From the Paley Center for Media in New York, this is Max Media. Here's Max Robbins.
Hi, everybody. Today's guest, Lewis Black, an old pal. No, a longtime pal. It's not that old.
No, it has been a long time. And I like that generic music intro.
Do you like that?
Yeah, that was that really, the excitement was palpable.
Yes, it is. You could. Nine Inch Nails. I know you're a big Nine Inch Nails fan. So I'm really happy you found time to see us. From what I understand, how many days of the year are you on the road?
About 150. I mean, 150 probably performances. But then I'm doing goofy meetings about things that aren't going to happen.
What's that like? I mean, 150 days on the road, man. You're away more than you're home.
Yeah. But did I ever really have a home, Max?
You always had a home in our hearts. You always knew where you could get a warm meal.
But the problem is, the thing is, when you start touring, so I started touring and I was going, when we probably first started knowing each other, I was going on the road. I was doing, I was doing five nights a week, two shows a night, or one show a night, two, three on, like eight, nine shows a week. I was gone five, 6 days a week, and I was gone like 45 weeks a year.
Wow.
So, I'd go to one city and hang out, and then it has evolved into, I'm lucky that I get to do it by tour bus. So that makes a huge difference. I mean, a huge difference to the point that the first 3 weeks I spent on the tour bus, the idea of going home made me sick.
Well, I remember back in the day when you were, you were starting to play Atlantic City and you were going to Vegas and whatnot. You like being out there. I mean, you like the action. You like the rooms. You like the fact that you got hot meals.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was broke for so long, and it was, it became the way I made a living, and it was, I liked was the fact that I'd been in New York, 10, 12 years, and been at grad school before, and I really had not seen the country, and there was anybody with any kind of sense of it thinks what if, right. what if there's the schools you wanted to go to or the cities you thought or the people say you see these pictures of places, you go, boy, Seattle must be great. Yeah, Seattle's really great if the sun is out. but you'd go to these places and I could actually spend time there. And what it did allow me to do was realize that my life choice was all right.
I
made a really good.
You could actually make a living and have some fun.
And I could live with my with the choice. So it's not so terrible, really. Because I'm some of the times most of the time I'm in I'm at home 3 days, I'm gone four. So in terms of the way some people are living. Somebody's working in D.C. and lives in New York and all of that stuff that people can go through. I'm still enjoying it.
You're still having fun. Do you find that there are the same things funny in different parts of the country as you travel around? I mean, does the same?
Thanks to cable. Yes, siree, America. Thanks to cable television. It is. It's true, though. That was where the difference, I could see the difference come, because I worked in the clubs before cable hit, and you'd have to tweak it a little, and you could really, in terms of humor. But with the advent of Comedy Central and XM and Sirius, which were huge in terms of, which have never been given their due in terms of the comic boom. When comedy kind of came back, it's come down to people, especially younger people, have developed a very sharp sense of humor, and the only time I really notice changing things is certain topics that you talk about. When this a few years ago, I would talk about the Bible in the South. Well, you can sense the audience tightening up, so you have to slow it down and kind of draw them into it. And but most of 90% and 95% of the time, and I was just in. I got an email. I was in guess Indianapolis, I forget which city where I was talking about healthcare, and there are Pfizer is there, and some major, you know, I got this email, it's like some major, health insurance company that I'd never heard of. And that couldn't believe Lewis went off like that on it and this and that, but it didn't seem to bother people. And it's really about whether it's funny.
Yeah, it just comes down to, is it going to make them laugh or not?
Exactly.
What I wonder too is, you talk about the advent of satellite radio not being given its due. For you, in a lot of ways, what was really big breakthrough was The Daily Show and Conan.
Yes.
You know, Conan O'Brien. Television sold you, but now you're all over the place, man. In fact, I know you're not a big fan of social networks.
Yeah.
Not a big fan of Twitter?
No.
No, really? Really? Because...
Do you Twitter?
I have on occasion. Don't punch me. I'm...
Because anything where somebody is actually tweeting, where that is the verb is to tweet.
To tweet.
To tweet is worse than the word fuck. It's a wrong word. It's a word, I mean, to say that, to take communication down to, well, I'm tweeting. It's pornographic.
Now, speaking of that, well, we can bring those two thoughts together, pornography and Twitter. Uh-huh. I was on Twitter before you came in this morning. I did a search function. I put your name in, and I want you to know that Miss Nikki on Twitter says she will sex you up.
Really? Is that right?
Yes.
How do I find Miss Nikki? What do you do? Seriously?
Yeah, there was.
Oh, come on.
Well, it's funny because initially I had the same feeling as you about Twitter and how to.
Now this is changing my mind.
I thought it would.
Well, now that we're tweeting. So you go on.
This is called tweeting with benefits.
what did you? You had the same feeling, and now.
And now, well, what's changed is the search function on Twitter, because what I find with that is, if you're doing research on a topic. I wanted to find out what people who are foolish enough to tweet were thinking about Lou Black. I just punched your name in the search function, and a bunch of stuff came up. I found out you got a wine you're launching.
Yes.
All proceeds go to charity. And I also found Miss Nikki.
That's unbelievable. So there's a search function. I just hate, oh, man. Now I got to go check.
You got another time suck in your life.
Really, is Miss Nikki, are there photos of Miss Nikki? No.
As a matter of fact.
it's a St. Bernard.
You can be a dog on the internet.
Someone's tweeting for their dog. I was offered money to go on Twitter. Not by Twitter. I mean, but basically, if I could maintain X amount of people following my tweets, that I could get, that they would pay me. And I just thought, I just don't like. I know people who do it. I've got friends. I mean, certain comics do it. I mean, I think that's when I start to feel old. That's when I go, I don't get it. I don't comprehend the idea. I've said it in my act. I don't get the idea of. First off, if someone is interested that my shoe size is, you know, what a discovery that they're making this Italian shoe really will come in at a 9, and I really wear an 11. I mean, I need to write that, and somebody would read that. And that I've stopped here for a Mocha Java Grande. What? Who reads this? Why would somebody read it? Why, if somebody is interested in following me on that level, it makes me, I'm incensed.
It's a little scary that they want to know that much about you.
That they want to know, but then that other people stand around describing what they do during the day. And my basic argument with it is this, that if you're describing what you're doing, then you're not doing it.
Wise words from Lou Black.
I'm serious, though. You're talking about what you're doing. You're not doing it, schmuck. And you're doing it because you think you have an audience that gives a shit what you're doing. That's no reason. What kind of life is that? And what's her name? And I heard this, that one of the girls from The Girls Next Door, which is an important breakthrough for your Those of you involved in television, yes, that was a major breakthrough. That you, Hefner, had these three women, and then one of them spun off and went to Vegas with a football player, and I can't remember her name. And she, I gather, and I did not. Maybe you can tweet later. $2 million a year. She makes $2 million a year.
Wow. Wow. $2 million a year. Well, maybe it's not such a bad thing. This is Max Media. We're here talking with Lou Black today about all sorts of things. You know, but Lou, you are a big hit in the world of social media. I mean, I tried to friend you on Facebook. Now, you probably blocked me.
And I did.
Yeah. But I found out you have too many friends.
No.
You cannot befriended on too many people, or your friend. Facebook can't handle all the people that want to be your
Come
friend.
Come on.
I'm not making this up.
Can I recycle them? Don't they have that farm thing now? You can have your own farm. Can I send some of my friends to my farm? Seriously? Yeah. You can only have some, for God's sake. You can get on MySpace with me.
Okay.
That's the only one I do. And I do it because it was like AOL. I'm like, that's it. I'm stuck with it, okay?
Right.
Like Monkey doesn't want to move. Monkey is taking a shit here.
I'm, you know, we were, Peter Herdrick, our producer here, we were talking this morning, and I know you guys have known each other a long time.
Too long.
Anyway, we were talking this morning about, you know, back in the day when you were holding fort in, the late 80s, early 90s at the West Bank Cafe, and how you used to come on with your clippings from the news, and you'd be outraged about something, and usually legitimately so. In fact, I can never think when you weren't legitimately pissed off. I mean, how much was that important in shaping your act and what you're doing now? And are you still drawing on basically those headlines and crazy stories?
Yeah, I'm it had a huge amount in terms of shaping my act, because I worked outside of the. I was not working in comedy clubs, and I think whatever became unique or original about my voice was made and it was shaped in there, because I wasn't the comics I was working with, John Bowman, who is now the guy who opens for me on the road. That he was the comic I was working with, and Rusty, who didn't go to clubs at that point. None of us did, you know. And the people coming in who were doing stand up were occasionally, I mean, friends of mine who I knew as stand ups would show up, but most of the time it was this kind of group of ragtags who were really not. And really, we're more interested in theater.
Right. You started out as a playwright. I mean, you went to Yale Drama School. You wrote literally hundreds of plays.
I wrote a ton of plays. I wrote a lot of plays to know for no reason, really, except really the benefit of I have no idea.
Why you wrote all those plays?
Well, I wrote them. I mean, I was interested in becoming a playwright. But when I look back on it, I'm thinking, wow, the amount of punishment I took from that profession. I mean, because the thing was, is that you went when, you know, and there were folks and there certainly now many of my friends are, you know, Richard Dresser, Jim Yashimura. There's an endless Willie Reale. There's an endless list of guys who worked and women too. Women who you know, Teresa Rebeck, who write plays and then do television. And then to just put it, you know, quite graphically, it simply really was just that, you know, in theater would just, you know, wouldn't pay you, and then they'd fuck you. And then television was the place they would fuck you for a lot of money.
Right, right. At least you were getting kissed while you were getting screwed.
Exactly. You know, that was the thing. And that's really the truth. But I think that the playwriting shaped my stand-up, because I think it... even because if I had to really sit down and think about it, but I mean, subconsciously, I know that it shaped the way that that I try to tell a story when I'm on stage, no matter how convoluted that story may be. And doing the stand-up, I was just different, because I wasn't working under any kind of, I wasn't in a comedy club every night. And not to say that the people coming out of there, I mean, I know a ton of them and they're brilliant. But I think it was probably better for me to be shaped to have been shaped in a room where I could really kind of, you know, do what I wanted to do and not have to shape it to the room. So that by the time I made it to the clubs and started going to clubs, It became really easy. I went, oh, this is what I do. This is the way the audience needs to have it delivered. And so it became really, I learned really quickly. And you do from, and that's the reason I love doing stand-up. You learn immediately from the audience. And so those 10 or 12 years that I spent really on the road in clubs was spent learning how what was it that would work for most people.
When
as opposed to the two of you.
Well,
you know, you guys were like,
I know. Give us a couple drinks, we'll laugh at anything.
But it's totally different. But it is. It's that there's that audience that really is. I mean, it's what's gone on now. They've got this thing called alternative comedy, which, for all intents and purposes, that's what we were doing there. You know, where it wasn't like punchline. We were trying to figure out what the punchline was, and that's really that made a huge difference.
When did you decide to go? Do you remember your first club date?
My first club date was, very first was in, I mean, not club, well, first club date. The very first date I did was in Chapel Hill at Cat's Cradle, which still exists, which was a music room, but that was when I was 20. And then the first club date would have been, wow, I don't know if it was.
Well, how did the switch go off? I got to get out of the basement of the West Bank.
They pushed us out of the basement. So, I mean, seriously, because, the guy who owned the place, Steve Olson, got kind of like shit-canned by the two, his null and void, his partners, as he called them. And we were bumped out. And so I started going over there.
Right, to the comic strip.
I would go to the comic strip and Catch, and I started to work those rooms. And then it was Catch was the first one who picked up on me and started. They sent me out. The first few gigs were like Princeton, Chicago, and Vegas, and those were the first three or four, maybe six gigs I did. I was you have an opener, a middle, and a headliner, and I was the middle. And then that was it. I only did most of the time. You'd have to middle or open forever, and then middle forever. But I had already amassed this amount of material working downstairs, and it was. And my act was kind of so this kind of unbridled yelling, screaming energy thing that it was tough for certain comics to follow, and also they just kind of. I was older when I went out, so by the time I was 37, 38, I'd already done all the stuff, so I jumped immediately to headlining. But it was Catch that really
Catch a Rising Star.
It was really the ones that was instrumental in getting me on the road. And then when I decided to make the switch entirely, it was with Bowman took me on the road for 30 days in Michigan in the summer, and I wanted to see if I would really like doing it, and I really liked it. It was great. I mean, it was fun because you were working every night. I mean, it was no different than working the West Bank in the sense that I could do a gig every night.
And you were you were trying to make a bunch of strangers laugh.
Yeah.
These days, are you still writing all your own material?
Yeah. I mean, there's John, actually, especially when it comes to the...
John Stewart.
No, John Bowman.
Ah.
John... when I'm getting closer to doing a special, he'll start watching. He watches. He'll come out and watch bits and pieces and go, you should do this or you should do that. And we know enough about each other that, I'll give him some advice. For the last thing, he had about five lines that were really, clutch for me. But most of it's me. I figure most of it out on stage. I don't write anything down.
You're an extremely successful guy now. And does it get harder to be funny when you're...
No, it gets... When it's hard is now when you've got... When I've just finished a special and I have to create a new act. I mean, that's the thing. It's that Seinfeld's movie, about... But that's really when it's tough. And the thing was is that I've been really good at it because what would happen was is I started to the all of the specials that I did or where I put stuff in the can, either a special or a CD, by the time I'm ready to put the CD out or the special out, I've already got it. I'm already moved on to the next. I already know what my next set is, so I'm already working on my next set. And this time due to HBO changing management due to some indiscretions. HBO dropkicked me for all intents and purposes. So I was told, I don't really get, this is one day I'm going to just want to get in a room with those pricks, because I was told, and this is why, you know, and this, you know, the business, this is, I'm told, you're going to be getting a special every 2 years. Well, perfect. You know, that's exactly the schedule I want. And, that'll be great. And so I finished this. I do the special for them. That special is nominated for an Emmy. You figure, okay. Then there's some things happen, and HBO comes and says, well, we're not going to be able to use you now, Lewis, for your special, because the next special, because you have your own show on another cable channel. Okay, so I mean, really, what?
Yeah, the show was on Comedy Central.
The show on Comedy Central, and since you work for another, and if you want to be, you know, to have your special, you can't be on. And I'm like, really? So I'm supposed to wait around?
It's like you can't work for the Gambinos if you want to work for.
Right. I mean, and it's an absurd concept, and as a result, I was redlining on. I put out a CD rather than a special. And then I was redlining on my next special, and we said, well, we'll do it. You know, I'm not doing a show anymore. And they went, well, you know, we don't have the budget for you this year. And that was it. And so I did it myself. So I did my next special on my own for yet another new cable channel called Epix.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. And this is a whole new deal. This is a new premium cable channel. It's been started by, Viacom's
behind it. It's Paramount.
And Lionsgate, I think.
Lionsgate and MGM. Now, and I'm their first special. But it's an interesting point in time, because I'm their first special for really, they don't, they're slowly gaining
distribution.
Distribution. So my special is out there.
But nobody. What if you made a special and nobody could watch it?
Yeah, no. But to their credit, you know, they stepped up to the plate and at least put me on the air for them. And no matter what the distribution was. So it's a rather remarkable. I mean. It's that thing. Well, we were talking before we went on the air about what's the next step in media. I mean, these guys have now, what they did was they took the Netflix model in part, and they basically, they have taken the step. Nobody seems to have the balls, and if they would just do it, except that they can't figure out how to distribute the income, since I left school, let's say 20 years ago, when the computer screen, started to get better. It was a television screen, so they've refused to marry the two of them for reasons that are beyond belief, except it's cash. It's got to be. It absolutely is.
Always comes down to the money.
It has to.
Yeah.
I had banked when I was an undergraduate. I kept seeing this as the future. I kept reading these books, you know, all of these guys, you know, like – you know, the guys who would write these kind of future books about what it was going to be like. And I thought, wow, this is going to be great for someone like me. Well, yeah, if I was born like 10 years ago, it would be great for me. It doesn't help me. It really was like not what it was. That's what I was preparing for, that world. And I would have to go, you know, I'd have to be seven now to really, when it's going to reach its fruition, where it just breaks down, where it becomes... You know, where it does do what it's going to do, which is, I believe, which is, I'm probably, so it means I'm wrong, where it doesn't matter if it's local programming, that it's, you know, because it's going to come out of anywhere, because people have access to everything, because that flip camera is 2 seconds away from being the multi, you can take that and do a film with it at some point.
Oh, I was looking at all sorts of clips of you on YouTube that people had taken with their telephone cameras and all sorts of stuff.
It's unbelievable. And we're you know, but that I couldn't, so that what Epix has done, and there's a step in it, is that they've married the computer stuff to their TV. And what they did was, which was the big, you know, and like it's huge. You're sitting there going, you're right. You know, you go on their thing, and I'm not, and this is not as a promo, it's just stupid technological horseshit. You go on their site, and their big thing is, and it is big, you're two clicks away from your movie. You click in, three clicks. You click into the site, you click the movie, it's on the air on your computer.
Great.
Okay, which is like the Netflix model.
Sure, sure.
But the other thing is that now what they're doing, and this is a generation, your generation, probably a prick, the engineer's generation.
Ian's very young. He's very young.
But, you know, it is probably yours. I don't get this, but that you can take a movie now that I can access a movie on my computer. Then I could send my movie. I could send an email to Ian, you want to see this movie. He could then go on and watch the movie with me from two different locations. We can hook up the...
You don't have to be in the same room with him right now.
Don't have to be five.
You know he doesn't bathe regularly.
But you take like five locations. I forget how many it is. He doesn't have to pay to come in. It's the intelligence of it is that you're also, you're doing really low blow advertising. So he's going, Trevor, I could do this. But here's the part I don't get. And this is once again where I feel old, that there's, you know, the boxes there where you can write to each other and talk about the movie while you're watching it. Is really going to be great for when you go to a movie. And you can yak to the person next to it. But that to me, and that you could, you know, I have the power to, I'm the only one with the power to stop the movie. But you can stop the movie and have your little conversation and da 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 da. And I said to them, couldn't you talk on the phone?
Oh, nobody wants to talk on the phone. They want to text. They want to text each other.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, nobody wants to do that.
So that's where it ended up, is that's where that my special ended up there. And then the next step is the goes to Comedy Central, and then
you see. What...
But the question, I kind of went through that rigmarole. But the question, but I think it was enlightening.
Peter fell asleep. I know, we had to wake him up.
Because he's seen the future and it scares him. Well, you know, for me, it's that transition. So by the fact that I was backed up against the wall now, holding on to this material, and I'd actually lost a chunk of other material because of it, and I kind of got it all out, and then really I had about 6 weeks before this was going to hit the air, and I've got probably a bit more time because it's not widespread, but for me, for my comfort level, to get out there and do a new act. So I'm about 40% into a new act.
Wow. And
that's when it's toughest. It's not success has, you know, as long as you enjoy it and know why you got into it and what it is that you know, because I love doing it. And as long as I keep evolving up there, you know, at least in my own mind, then I feel really comfortable about it. Success is a two-edged sword, but it really is. If you keep your mind where it should be on being funny, it allows you an audience that gives you. It's like being in the West Bank. I mean, my audience allows me to do things that I think are wrong as a performer.
We're listening to the always very wrong yet very right, Lou Black. This is Max Media, Lou. With the you know, young comics coming up now. I mean, do they have the same opportunities you had? Has it gotten easier, harder, the same?
I think it's, there's always an exchange. I think it's harder in ways in terms of clubs. It's tougher to support yourself. It's harder in the sense, too, that more people see it as an option, which is just disturbing. You know, it was disturbing when I was coming up that there were people who
thought they could actually do this for a living.
You know, yeah, you know, people who should be lawyers or doctors or whatever, and then, you know, but I'm really funny. that it was seen as a legit. I mean, probably the worst thing that happened in comedy is it started to be seen as a legitimate profession.
Well, that's always been at the heart of a lot of what you do. I mean, there's kind of this real anti-dilettante nature, like, oh, hey, I'm funny too. I can tell a couple jokes. I can go do this, make a living.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. I think it's. It seems too that kind of what pisses you off about what's happening with a lot of social media and all this stuff. That hey, I'm a writer. I blog.
It is. It's exactly it. That blog shit is really more than I can bear. Typing into cyberspace does not make you a writer. I think it's great, but, you know, it's, again, the two-edged sword. I think it's great that people do it. The public nature of it becomes mildly disturbing, and then because it's just, if it was really important, if it weren't in the public eye, would you fucking do it, you fucking piece of shit? No. You wouldn't be sitting there with your dear, you wouldn't be, you know, if it was Dear Diary, you wouldn't be doing it, would you, douchebag? I forgot to ask if this, does this get, I guess it gets bleeped. But it is, it's stupid. And then though, it, you know, in the end, it's good because they're doing their writing. And that's really, you know, anything that where people communicate. But it's still that it, then certain, you know, I'm watching that Julie and Julia thing, that movie, that fucking Cookorama thing, which I passed out before the end. And it wasn't their fault, really. It wasn't the fault of the actors. It was a plane ride. I could barely get enough oxygen. But I'm watching that. I'm watching that, and she goes, "This is years ago." Now she's blogging on Slate, which the one thing I know, I remember, you know, Slate was the only one that was, we're going to do this. We're going to be a magazine, but we're going to be in cyberspace, Slate. So that she was blogging on that and gained notoriety for fucking, like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm sitting there going, what, where is your life that you're reading somebody who is doing all of Julia Child's recipes? It's not what? Is wrong with, that's all I thought is, what is wrong with this person? And she seems fairly normal. I mean, she's, I mean, I get what she's doing, but who are these people? Oh, yeah, fans. Fans of fucking, you're not even there watching her cook. It's beyond belief. It's really, seriously, we have, I've always said, I used to say it at the West Bank, I think the American economy could be changed tomorrow. You put a put 3 to 4 cameras in everyone's homes so that we can watch anybody, any home. I mean, we're a moment away from it anyway, so just do it. And then every home can be its own network, and then you can send it out to the rest of the world so that they could turn on, you know, the Peter Herdrick show in Oslo. And the people gathering around, look, oh, Peter's
huge opening, in Helsinki.
He's opening another fine bottle of wine. Come gather around the hearth. Jesus. It's, I mean, it really is. It's, you just go, it makes no sense to me. It makes no sense. I don't get it. But for young comics, but what that presents in terms of that type of access, in terms of, you know, what they lose in terms of club work, they gain, and it certainly puts them in a different direction, but they can write sketches and get them up. I mean, that Andy Stamberg who goes on to be, you know, does this thing on YouTube, and then they hire him. You know, I mean, it's you're basically allowed to audition, you know, 24/7, you know, in search of your viral video.
But you're losing that thing that happens. I got to think that there's no replacement for what happens in a club when you're up there dying or you're up there and you're killing it.
Yeah, no, it makes a huge difference. I mean, the ones eventually, in terms of stand-up, I mean, the guys who were really went on to be the great ones are the ones who go out there and slug it out. I mean, that's why it's a, you're going to get off the road. No, I mean, it's still fun, and that's where you do it. The everything else is a sidebar to it. I mean, there's Kathleen Madigan. My friend Kathleen Madigan is I think, this will probably put the kiss of death on her career, but I believe she's like a moment away from kind of exploding, and a lot of it has to do with that she spent this massive amount of time on the road and is, you know, it's like being a club fighter in a sense. I mean, I've always compared it to fighting. It's that, you know, you know that's how you do it. You fight 40 amateur bike, you know, 40 fucking bouts, and then all, you know, and then you get to go to the next level.
Well, we know you'll keep going to whatever level there is to go to. Lou Black, we'd like to thank you for joining us today. This has been a blast, and I
that
really
was fun. Thanks.
Well, anytime, man. Anytime.
You know, I'm not working with Ian again.
Nor am I.
No, it was great, and I hope that I didn't bother people with that language because I know how disturbing it is.
Well, this is formerly a museum. Let's thank Lou Black. This is Max Media.
You've been listening to Max Media, a production of the Paley Center for Media in New York City. We're on the web at paleycenter.org. That's P-A-L-E-Y center.org. And you can reach us by email at maxmedia@paleycenter.org.